Veritasium, and Marquee. Let's go.
I'm here with MKBHD, and we're going to try to steal $10,000 from his locked iPhone.
Really hope it doesn't work. Really hope it doesn't work.
I'm going to get you to put that phone down on top of this device.
Okay.
Just put it down there.
Just put it on, like, all right.
I feel like I'm a bit of a magician, but I'm like, I haven't changed anything, right?
Okay, yeah.
It's still locked.
It's locked.
Okay.
Nothing else.
Okay. Yeah.
This is just a regular payment terminal. Nothing weird about that.
Seen these.
We'll start with a little, like, maybe 100. No, maybe $5. Let's start with something like...
Five.
Let's start with five.
Five sounds great. Yeah, $5.
Do you think that we can take... Like, will we be able to get this out of your phone?
I hope not, but I kind of feel like you will. let's see.
So now I'm going to charge $5 on this device. Mm-hmm. Your phone's still locked, right?
Yep.
I haven't done anything.
Like a David Blaine.
It's like the nerdiest David Blaine.
Yeah.
Sweet. So just try a tap. We'll go.
What?
What just happened on my phone? Whoa, approved. So, okay. I heard something happen on my phone while you tapped this on this.
Yes. We got a little receipt for you.
Credit verified on device, $5. So, I'm gonna check my phone. I have a new $5 charge. And it's time stamped right now.
Holy shit.
I don't like that at all. So that's concerning. Oh, so my phone had to be on this thing.
Yes.
Did it have to be on this thing?
What the fuck is that thing?
Or like near it, I guess?
So the way, well, I could explain how it works, but maybe before that, $5, it's not very much.
Yeah.
Do we want to try upping it a bit?
I'm
going to enter a slightly larger amount.
Careful. Careful with that. Careful, careful. That's a lot of zeros. Careful with that. Oh my God. Okay.
Do you even think it's possible? Firstly, $10,000.
I mean, the limit on the card is above that. I don't know if Apple Pay will let you do that.
Wait, I have a theory.
The question.
The real meme would be that usually your bank will flag suspicious transactions like that if you haven't done it before and if you're out of zip code. But what's your theory? What do you think it's going to be?
My theory is that Apple, for some stupid reason, lets you do really small payments, like $5, without unlocking your phone for small bullshit. But if you try to go over it, it doesn't work. That's my theory.
I don't believe that. Do you know what this device thing is here in the middle?
It looks like an NFC reader.
I wonder if there's like some hack. Well, no, it can't be a hack or an open thing because they wouldn't be publishing this video, right? So who knows?
It has to be like Apple sets something so that you can like use your Subway card without unlocking your phone or something. And it's like there's a $5 maximum charge and above that it doesn't work.
Maybe.
It's also, are you used to spending this amount of money on this card? You
know? Not from my phone. This is like
phone.
A big screen activity. Like $10,000 purchase, I gotta be checking everything. So this would be unusual.
Let's see it. Let's see if it works. Okay, I'm gonna do it again.
Okay.
We're just all we gotta do again, put your phone locked.
Phone
on this device.
Locked. On that device.
Yes, exactly.
And man, we got the drama music and everything. Okay,
start the script again. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Holy.
Mm-mm.
Oh, what? Hold on, wait. I don't know what the fuck this thing is. The thing?
Uh-huh.
What is
wait,
the thing?
Wait, it's a relay. Wait. I think I know what's happening here.
What's happening?
You know how people can like steal your car by like going near your door of your house with like a thing to like broadcast your key fob way farther? You know what I mean? Normally your key fob would only work if you're within 10 feet of your car.
Okay.
He's putting this dude's phone there and the phone is emitting something that the other phone is then picking up and then somehow retransmitting it with authorization.
Okay.
That's my guess. What's your guess?
Are we supposed to know what that one device is?
Well, that one device, that's his. Okay, on the right.
Okay.
Well,
hold on.
Exactly. And, okay, we're going to start the script again. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we have four things here. We have Marquis's phone on the right.
Yeah.
Basically like a RFID reader or an NFC reader or something plugged into a computer. And a terminal. You see the square terminals on the left-hand side. And the guy's attacker phone. So the computer is rebroadcasting the RFID or the NFC from Marquez's phone to this dude's phone.
Oh my God. It can't possibly be this, but this is my guess.
Apple Pay. Tap to pay. Yes. Does Apple have that? Apple. Can you do tap to pay?
Yeah, that's what Apple, that's what it is. Yeah.
So he's making this phone think it's tapping when it's not, maybe.
My guess is, but it can't be this. This would be so stupid. When you go to tap in order to authorize a payment from whatever the Apple Pay thing is, Apple's security software is doing a check to see if you've unlocked your phone first in order to authorize the payment. And the attacker phone is being authorized because the guy is typing in the code or looking at the face thing. So it's saying, okay, good. You've bypassed the security thing. So now you can make the payment. However, the payment broadcast request or whatever that's being broadcasted from that phone is actually being routed through the victim's phone. But the bypass is being done on the security of the attacker phone. But then the payment credentials and everything are being passed along through the original iPhone. Imagine if you have a Windows operating system on your computer and I can't hack into it. So then what I do is I install another Windows operating system on top and then I log into my OS and suddenly I'm logged into your OS. That would be so stupid. So I can't possibly, but I don't know. We'll see.
No, just green approved.
Print that up. Oh, we did that. That is crazy.
This video is a part two. There's a part one where they show the tech. Well,
no.
We're not watching. We don't need that one. We're experts. We're old.
Yeah, I'm gonna need that back.
Yeah,
for sure. I'm gonna need that back. But also, did that just... Yeah, wow. It worked.
$10,000.
All right. I believe you. I definitely believe you. How do we get this back? We do like a little Venmo or like PayPal?
You know, do we give it back though?
Reverse the transaction? I don't even know. Do I call my...
Yes, it's abusing the auth from the attacker phone to use the Apple Pay from the victim phone. The issue is that it seems you need to already physically access the victim phone, so it's not that scary, maybe. Well, but the issue is that anytime you scan a victim's phone, you could theoretically authorize a much larger secondary transaction somewhere else and print a fake receipt and just hope they don't check their email or whatever in the meantime, right? Theoretically?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Also, this would just be, I'm sure, this would just be a really stupid authorization vulnerability in general. Like, almost...
This is, like, bullshit and, like, a fake transaction. I'm going to be fucking pissed. Like,
no,
just
that would be dumb.
Didn't go through.
Right. Exactly.
Actually, I'm so sorry. That's stupid. You could just steal somebody's iPhone. This would give you access to whatever payment thing they're connected to on the phone itself, which would also be really bad.
Just if you want to get it framed.
A receipt of the damage. I never unlocked my phone. I never put in the password. I never did what I would normally do to verify a transaction on my phone.
Yes.
It just happened to be on top of that.
So how did we do it? Well, we teamed up with two cybersecurity experts, Professors Ioana Borenu and Tom Chofia, and we went to visit them at the University of Surrey, where they ran us through a unique hack that they developed to bypass a phone's lock screen and then to drain funds from inside its mobile wallet.
Without unlocking my phone is the real magic part. That's crazy.
And the craziest thing of all is that this hack was made public back in 2021. So people have known that it's possible to take money from locked phones in this way for 5 years.
So what kind of amounts does this...
The only limit is how much someone has in their bank account.
Yet the loophole still hasn't been fixed.
So how does it work? Well, whenever you use Tap to Pay, your phone and the reader exchange information about the transaction. But they send this information through the air via a shared magnetic field. So we can intercept the communication and alter it. All we need to do is to insert our own devices in between the phone and the reader. First, we tap Marquez's phone against this. It's an NFC device called a Proxmark. To Marquez's phone, the Proxmark looks like a typical card reader. So it happily sends over its transaction data. That Proxmark then sends that data straight to our laptop, where we run a Python script to modify it.
So these types of like man-in-the-middle attacks should be, unless I'm missing something, shouldn't these all be really easily defeated by encryption somehow? Like, generally, this, like, get in the middle of a thing and then intercept the data stream and modify the data stream. This type of stuff, these are, like, 1990s or 2000s attacks on things. Like, unless there's, for some reason, this type of tap or magnetic thing or whatever, like, the digital data just doesn't get encrypted or something.
Next, the laptop sends the data to our burner phone, which I tap on the actual card reader. To the reader, my phone looks just like Marquez.
Because I also don't understand how it defeats the... Well, we'll see, I guess.
So both Marquez's phone and the card reader think they're talking directly to each other, when in fact, all their communication goes through our series of devices. This is a classic man-in-the-middle attack.
Now, getting in the middle to intercept the data is actually the easy part. The hard part is what you need to do to that data to trick the phone and the reader into authorizing the transaction.
Yeah, that's the interesting part.
See, to actually steal money using this attack, you have to get past three layers of defense on both systems. And to do that, we have to tell three lies. Two to the phone, and one to the reader. So, the first layer of defense is the simplest. The phone is locked. And in an ordinary transaction, you have to unlock your phone to pay. But this is no ordinary transaction.
So, you know, if you ever go to the subway, there's a feature that Apple's created where, you know, when you walk through, they don't want...
What?
Nothing. I think I said something like this. Go ahead.
Oh.
Transaction, you have to unlock your phone to pay. But this is no ordinary transaction.
So, you know, if you ever go to the subway, there's a feature that Apple's created where, you know, when you walk through, they don't want a bunch of people lining up and, you know, having to unlock their face and, you know, maybe they're wearing a coat and glasses and stuff.
Express Transit Mode.
Apple introduced Express Transit Mode in 2019.
What? Okay. Okay, fuck. This was the second thing I was going to guess, but this would be even more stupid. It's not possible that for certain types, the question was going to be, is there a green list of certain device IDs that don't require you to unlock your face or unlock the phone in order to pay? But that would be so stupid that you could just have one of these green listed devices and then charge an infinite amount of money. That would just be so dumb. There's no shot. That would be so stupid.
Yeah. Let you make
whitelist.
Transactions without having to unlock your phone. The way this works is that the payment terminals on the subway or on the bus broadcast a message that identifies them as a transit terminal. Then when you tap your phone to pay, it looks for whatever card is in the transit slot of its mobile wallet, and it pays without needing to unlock.
This is super convenient, but we can...
I didn't even know this. Fuck, well now I feel like a retard, because every time I'm in Europe, I'm always unlocking my phone before I tap my phone to pay.
Also abuse it.
We found out how this worked by going to the London Underground with our laptops and our equipment and actually scanning the signals and seeing what the gate was saying to the phone. And that's how we discovered this code the gate send, which unlocked the phone.
We used the Proxmark to broadcast that same code, which fools Marquez's phone into thinking that it's a transit reader. So when we tap Marquez's phone against the Proxmark, it's now expecting to receive another message with the details about the transit transaction. Here's what that message would typically look like in binary code.
Wow, thanks.
Each of these bits carries important information about the transaction. Now, the important part of this message for us is this bit. An authentic transit transaction would have a 1 right here. This tells the phone that the reader may be offline, like if it's underground on the subway, in which case the phone would need to send an extra layer of authentication. So when Marquez's phone receives the transaction request from what it thinks is a transit reader, it's going to be expecting that value to be set to 1. But in reality, the device sending the request is our retail reader. And this reader is online, which means that that bit is currently set to 0. Therefore, to trick the phone into accepting the transaction, we intercept the message from the reader, pass it through our computer, and we change that 0 to a 1. So by the time the message gets to Marquez's phone, it looks like a transit transaction.
As this communicates through our computer, we're convincing the phone that it is in fact talking to a transit terminal.
But now there's a second line of defense we need to break.
With this first lie, we bypass the need to unlock the phone, and we can now trick it into making small payments of a few dollars, the kind you'd expect on the subway. But if we suddenly went and asked the phone for $10,000, well, its guard would go way back up. After all, it's pretty unusual for a transit reader to ask for such a large amount of money.
I need to pay attention to this video.
To a transit terminal.
Bypass
the transaction. The message gets to Marquez's phone. It looks like a transit transit.
It can't be that simple. That can't possibly be the case. There's just no way. I don't know. Maybe, okay.
Convincing the phone that it is in fact talking to a transit terminal.
But now there's a second line of defense we need to break.
With this first lie, we bypass the need to unlock the phone, and we can now trick it into making small payments of a few dollars. The kind you'd expect on the subway. But if we suddenly went and asked the phone for $10,000, well, its guard would go way back up. After all, it's pretty unusual for a transit reader to ask for such a large amount of money. So this activates a second layer of defense, customer verification. On contactless payments like this, there are two categories of transaction. We got high value and low value. Any transaction that's classified as high value requires additional verification from the customer.
For example, in the UK, most banks require a PIN or fingerprint or facial recognition for any transaction over £100. So for us to get this $10,000 payment through without customer verification, we need to trick the phone into thinking that $10,000 is in fact a low value transaction.
There's no way.
And that's actually surprisingly simple.
That's because to determine whether the transaction is high value, Marquez's phone doesn't actually look at the numerical value of $10,000.
It hashes it into either a 1 or a 0. No, I don't know.
It just looks at another single bit of information.
No! This can't be. No! That is can't possibly be the case. It can't be this stupid. This is...
Dude, I thought they were going to do something cool. Be like, we tell the phone that we're taking 500,000 Indian rupees, and then we change it to dollar signs.
Oh, because there's actually a microservice that runs for a currency converter checker, and we use a buffer overflow to insert our own URL into there that verifies with another server on the currency conversion, and that's how we trigger. Yeah, it can't be this stupid.
In the transaction data. A 1 here means high value, and 0 means low. The reason for this is that the boundary between high and low value varies from country to country. And of course, different countries operate in different currencies. So a simple label allows the flexibility to deal with these variations, and it allows the limits to be changed without the banks needing to issue new cards. So all we need to do is intercept the message from the reader, flip that bit to a 0, and then the phone will believe that this transaction is low value, even though it's for $10,000. Then, when the phone receives our request for a $10,000 transaction, it doesn't ask for customer verification. It just goes ahead and authorizes the transaction.
Now, you might be asking, why is this data so easy to tamper with? And we'll get to that in just a minute. But we have one final security check to overcome. See, with these first two lies, we bypassed unlocking the phone and then tricked it into making a high-value transaction without asking for verification. So the phone is fully convinced, and it's ready to make the payment. But we still need to convince the reader that the transaction's valid.
And this is where our third lie comes in. When Marquez's phone replies, it says it's approved the $10,000 transaction. But it also says that it hasn't asked for customer verification. No PIN, no fingerprint, no facial recognition. But if the reader sees this, it'll reject the transaction. Because it knows that the $10,000 payment it originally asked for is high value. It should therefore require customer verification. So now we need to trick the reader into thinking that the customer has verified the payment. So we intercept the response from Marquez's phone.
Oh my God. Do you see the time on the phone? It's leet. That's crazy.
Customer has verified.
I feel like I'm watching a shitty hacker movie. Now we make the third number. It's expecting a 1 and we're gonna put a 0.
The payment. So we intercept the response from Marquez's phone and look for the bit of information that says customer verification hasn't been done. Then we change it to say that the payment has been verified by flipping this 0 to a 1.
You heard about the, I always say SSL, but it's not SSL. SSH, yeah, sorry. That was like a really sophisticated actor that was compromising several projects. In order to make this vulnerability work, they had to like compromise like another library, and then that library was going to be called on the code.
Oh, you're talking about like the Zhang Li shit, yeah. Whatever the fuck that guy's name was. Like for 8 years, he maintain a product.
This was like a huge attack that would have like involved like multiple projects of like to call in like extra, like... It was very impressive, very sophisticated. This is retarded. I don't know.
Jia Tian, not Jing Li.
Now the reader's happy. It forwards the information onto the bank, and the bank authorizes the payment. After all, it sees a transaction that's been verified by the customer on their device.
Green, approved.
That is crazy.
Verified on device?
Yeah,
verified.
You didn't verify it.
Right.
So why isn't all this information encrypted?
That would make it impossible to secretly tamper with. Well, the way the phone and reader communicate has to be compatible with thousands of different devices, which would be impossible to update all in one go.
Oh, true, because RSA and all the other encryption methods are, like, just invented in the year 2022. What? I don't understand this.
So for that reason, the information we've looked at so far is just sent across unencrypted. Even still, phones, readers, and banks all have checks in place to make sure an attack like this can't happen. And normally it can't. Except if you happen to use a specific type of phone and a specific type of card. Because when you combine them in this particular scenario, they create a loophole.
So our hack relied on a specific phone and credit card combination. We also use a sophisticated method developed by cybersecurity experts. But hackers or scammers online, well, they don't need to be that smart. Often they can just...
because they can just brute, because they just have millions of things to show. Okay, I feel like this is going to be the most interesting part of the hack.
Just buy and...
the ad?
What?
The advertisement is going to be the most interesting part of the hack?
Oh, yes. No, whatever... if they had to use like a certain combination of two things because they happen to have two like rare vulnerabilities that on their own don't do much, but then when combined or something, maybe? I don't know.
Information to target you. When I started working at Veritasium, I was on a work trip to go meet Derek.
He's giving us a good video.
And I got an email from... somebody was saying he was Derek, asking for my phone number. That made a ton of sense. I was leaving the airport, so I just responded by sending my phone number. I immediately was like, wait, let me look at that. I checked the email, not Derek. Of course, for the next few months, I was just getting scam call after scam call. That's one way they can get you. I felt like an idiot, but it's not just scam calls like that. I've also had that feeling after news of a major data breach. I've wondered whether me using some website has led to my personal information being exposed somewhere without me even knowing about it. But you can protect your personal info with today's sponsor, Incogni.
Redact.
See, whenever scammers purchase your email, phone number, and even your home address from data brokers, Incogni automates the grueling process of requesting that these data brokers delete your information.
Crazy. Okay, so I've had this since June 2025. And since then, we've had 94 different removal requests.
And I really like how you can track the progress in this dashboard here. They've estimated that that saved me 70 hours and 30 minutes of my own time if I were to reach out to these people myself. And with Incogni's new custom removal feature in their unlimited plans, you can point to any specific site where your information is visible. And then one of their privacy agents will take care of the rest. So to take your data off the market today, go to incogni.com/veritasium.
That's not good.
And then use code Veritasium for 60% off. You can click the link below, or you can scan this QR code to claim that 60% off and get your personal data off the market. I want to thank Incogni for sponsoring this video about taking money from Marques Brownlee. And now, let's get back to that thing.
We have this in Redact.
So
it's
which
free.
Combination of card and phone make this hack possible? Firstly, the phone has to be an iPhone. As we saw earlier, when an iPhone is deciding whether to ask for customer verification, it doesn't look at the numerical value of the transaction. It only looks at the high value or low value label provided by the reader.
But other phones don't work that way.
For example, when a Samsung phone goes into transit mode, it doesn't rely on this low value label from the reader. It looks at the actual numerical value of the transaction, and it only accepts a payment of $0. Then it relies on the transport provider to count up all the times you've used the subway, and then to send you a bill at the end of the day. So if a Samsung phone saw a transit terminal trying to charge you $10,000 for a single tap, it would immediately reject it.
But it's not just Apple's transit mode that makes this hack possible. You've got to have one specific type of card in the transit slot.
It was truly a design feature that was introduced by the way you mixed Apple and Visa.
And the reason that this works with a Visa card, but wouldn't, let's say, a MasterCard, comes down to the different processes they use to verify transactions.
So what is it about Visa's verification process that makes this hack possible?
In a previous video, we saw that any card transaction relies on a secret cryptographic key shared by the card in the bank. When you tap the card or phone onto a reader, the reader sends across a long string of transaction details. The card then applies its secret key to garble that message into a unique code for the transaction. The card sends this to the reader, which the reader forwards onto the bank, along with the raw transaction details. The bank then applies its own secret key to the raw data as well, and if the output matches the one from the card, the bank authorizes the transaction. This is called symmetric cryptography, since the card and the bank use the same secret key. And this step is required in all transactions, no matter whether you have a Visa, a MasterCard, or something else. But there's actually another layer of security, which MasterCard uses in all of its transactions, but in this particular case, Visa doesn't. This layer of security is not between the card and the bank, but between the card and the reader. And it's at this step where MasterCard thwarts our attack. The second step relies on asymmetric cryptography, so-called because it uses two different keys, a private key for the card and a public key for the reader. It starts with the reader sending across the transaction details to the card, just like before. The card then uses its private key to garble that message into another long string of digits. This is the card's digital signature for the transaction.
Wait, Visa doesn't do this?
I just don't understand why. I feel like this is like standard. Isn't asymmetric
encryption? PGP.
Yeah, isn't this like literally every single thing, like all, like isn't this HTTPS as well? Like, isn't this like this asymmetric encryption thing, how you communicate with literally every single, I don't even know if there is HTTP like websites anymore that aren't encrypted. That's why I feel so weird that tap to pay, like, because when you're talking about financial stuff, this is the most heavily, should be most heavily protected, guarded type of information. I don't know, it's just crazy. I don't understand.
The signature back to the reader, along with the public key, which the reader then uses to verify that the signature came from that specific card for this specific transaction.
To illustrate how this works, let's consider a simple example.
The private key and public key both have two components. N is a shared number, in this case, let's say 55. D is the card's private number, let's say 7. And E is the public number, let's say 3. Now, when the reader sends across the raw transaction data, it represents it as one long number. But for simplicity, we'll use a much smaller one. Let's say 2.
Thanks.
To sign for the transaction, the card or the phone raises the transaction number, in this case 2, to the power of its private number. So we get 128. And then it divides this by the shared number, 128 over 55, which leaves a remainder of 18. And this is the card signature, 18, which it sends on to the reader. Now, the reader needs to know whether the transaction is valid. So it takes the card's signature and raises it to the power of the public number. Then it takes the remainder when you divide by the shared number, 55. And you get 2. This matches the original transaction data the reader sent to the card. The reason this works is that the private and public numbers are specifically chosen, so that when combined with the shared number, the public key effectively reverses the operation of the private key. And this allows the reader to verify that the card's signature is valid, without ever having seen its private number.
What? Encryption? That's crazy.
This is based on a type of cryptography called RSA. In reality, the numbers involved are much larger.
But that makes it incredibly secure, because that makes it virtually impossible to reverse engineer the card's private key. And it also means that even a one-digit change in the transaction data will produce a different result when the reader checks the phone's signature. In which case, the reader won't approve the transaction.
This is a problem because we've modified the data. The reader's expecting a signature for a high-value retail transaction. But we intercepted the communication, so the phone's signature is actually for a low-value transit transaction. This wouldn't pass the asymmetric signature check. But while MasterCard always requires this asymmetric verification, which would spot our hack, Visa doesn't. They only require this signature in certain situations, like when the reader's offline. For example, when you're underground with no signal, there's no way for the reader to communicate with the bank for that first layer of symmetric cryptography, at least not until it comes back online. So during our attack, we make sure the reader is online the whole time. That way, it doesn't bother using the asymmetric layer of security, which contains the signature that would unravel our lives. But the funny thing is, we've tricked the phone into thinking it's interacting with the transit reader. And transit transactions are one of those times where Visa does require the asymmetric signature, since the reader could be underground on the subway, and therefore offline. So the phone actually does send across its signature to the reader, but the reader doesn't check it, because in reality, the reader's online. So instead, it just relies on that first layer of security with the bank. Even though, if it did check the phone's signature, it would have all the evidence it needed to stop the hack.
So yeah, there you go.
It makes sense that it's that sophisticated, because it shouldn't be that easy, but that still seemed way too easy.
And Marquez was not the only victim. I thought it was only fair that I first try it out on myself.
Yeah, here, your souvenir from the UK, from Tom and me.
Oh, what a lovely receipt for this theft.
And then I got another victim with a bit of a bigger budget.
Our channel has a like CFO, basically, who lives very nearby.
What we're doing is we're setting it to be your transit card.
Okay.
So that means that if you're in London, you have to use the tube. Yeah. It'll take money from this card. Something just happened.
Yep.
How you feel about that?
Oh my goodness me. Oh my God.
There you go.
We were just going to meet for a drink. That was the agreement.
In the real world, say you had your phone in your pocket.
Yeah.
I would walk by you doing this.
Dude, all of those fucking boomers that were getting triggered on those videos were actually just really... What?
They had a reason to be.
Yeah, upset. They were just really sophisticated engineers who knew the risks and were getting upset because they knew they could have been having their money taken. Oh my God.
And Tom would have this in the shop and pay.
The easiest way for this to actually be a crime would be a stolen iPhone.
Sure.
And then someone goes and spends thousands of pounds.
So, you know, you could buy a car with this.
Yeah.
Gee, I thought this was going to be like some obscure, like you need like an Ask Jeeves card from 2012 and like an iPhone 8. And they're like, you need a specific card. A specific card and phone combo. You need an iPhone and a Visa. Okay. So, like, what do you think that is? Like, 70% of all fucking phone users in America? Like, or what is the iPhone market share? It's still really high, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't want to be a brokey with an Android.
Or MasterCard. Got him.
Well, MasterCard has some good cards.
Oh, Dan's mad.
Visa is the most brokey of them. Well, besides, like, Discover, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. I guess from your perspective, you've revealed all this information publicly, and you're telling us. We're walking in through it in great detail. How do we stop people from using this can we stop people? Like, whose responsibility is it to stop this?
Oh, whose responsibility is it is an interesting question.
Yeah.
But you can stop it by turning transit mode off.
Or not turn it off and not have a Visa card in transit mode on an Apple.
Yes.
And you do need to be careful, because as soon as you have a suitable card in your Apple Wallet, Express Transit Mode is turned on by default.
This hack was first made public way back in 2021. After the professors had informed Apple and Visa privately. And to get to the bottom of why it's still possible, we reached out to Apple. And they didn't agree to an interview. But here's what they said.
Uh-oh. This is a concern with the Visa system. But Visa does not believe this kind of fraud is likely to take place in the real world. Visa has made it clear that their cardholders are protected by Visa's zero liability policy. This is exactly the same as their position when the hack was first made public back in 2021.
So it seems like Apple are basically saying, well, this is a Visa problem. So we went and asked Visa what they thought.
I think this specific vulnerability is likely within a controlled setting, very unlikely from a scaled real world setting. And then kind of the last point is from a consumer perspective, is that in the cases where this is successful, they have the ability to dispute this transaction and get their refunds returned to them.
I think that's fair. You're saying it's not entirely scalable, and then even if it does happen, we'll give you your money back. Like that's a great stance.
No, it's not. It's shit. You know why it's shit? It's shit because fucking iPhone thieves now have a reason to fucking steal your goddamn iPhone more than they did before. Yep. It doesn't matter that the person gets their fucking money back. The dude is like, I'm gonna steal a fucking iPhones, and you give me a reason to. Fuck you, Visa.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. You're saying it's not entirely scalable, and then even if it does happen, we'll give you your money back. Like that's a great stance. I still think though, a lot of people, and I think our audience would really want to hear that you're actually making the technical changes to stop this from ever happening again.
Is when you think about it from a scale perspective, and whether the net.
You know what this is? It's
anytime.
A Hassan Piker interview.
No,
it's a Hassan
Piker
interview.
Kind of, but no, yes. this is Corpo speak. Whenever somebody Corpo says scale, what they're saying is, could we fix it? Yes. However, the cost to fix this particular thing is going to be less than the liability we just pay out for it, so fuck it. That's what that means. For anytime the word scale is brought up, fuck it. We'd pay.
Also, it's relying on fucking me or you realizing, like, did I pay $10 for something?
Yeah, so now I've got to fucking call the robot and do my... to get my money back from Visa and get a new card and all this other bullshit or whatever. Ugh.
Our level of defenses that we have are effective in making sure that this type of vulnerability is isolated. We believe it is effective. Because if it wasn't, you would hear a lot more data about how this is an issue, and it simply isn't. The point that I'm making is that you're never going to be able to...
This is like I don't know. This is just one of the funniest, like... from all the fucking shit that fucking Cake would drill into my head, and like just people I've known in the past that worked in these environments where like security is important. If something is like vulnerable at some point in time, then you just consider the entire thing compromised, you scrap it and you restart. You would never like have some kind of like your password was here or something was leaked here or whatever, but like nobody probably saw it, so it's okay, so we're just going to keep going like nothing ever happened. Like this idea of like I don't think and I think also like a big issue is not only one should this be like solved, ideally like they should be working on a solution they haven't already, because if this did become a big problem, what are you going to do, shut down all of these payments until they figure it out? I think another scary thing is who's to say that there isn't going to be some other type of attack that's going to work in conjunction with this one. Like oftentimes when these big zero days are found that like let you compromise systems and take over a ton of money or whatever, fuck shit, like usually it's like multiple different attacks that can be stacked on top of one another. So like who's to say that somebody couldn't figure out some other vulnerability in one of these systems and then use this attack on top of that? Like fucking with the way that these systems work, who's to say that the fucking your pacemaker doesn't get shut down if there's a zero in some digit because now cards are doing this over unencrypted RFC fucking transmission? Like that's just it's crazy to have like an open vulnerability like this in existence that can be defeated pretty easily. Like this is defeated pretty easily. Like seems like we could buy the equipment and figure out how to do this tonight, and it's not like a very rare set of users. Like if this was like, this is for people that have Linux systems from 1987 that are on a certain processor architecture or whatever, it's like it's not that, it's a really common like set of circumstances.
Explain to me why the fuck would they even rely on, hey, can you set a one if this is a lot of money? How about you just fucking look at the number that's getting sent, retard? Okay, I don't need you to be like, one, it's a high value. How about it's $10,000? Is that over your fucking threshold, dipshit?
Yeah, I don't
like,
know. I don't
that
understand.
Is so stupid, unbelievably stupid, that the iPhone's like, oh, okay, sure. And they didn't explain that.
I don't get it.
Completely eradicate any specific type of fraud because it's going to exist, right?
Yes.
What I'm saying is that we have the right detections in place to ensure that this type of fraud is not endemic.
Like, I can't imagine the engineers that were called to work on this were like, all right, guys, we've got a vulnerability. It impacts about 50% of users. We need you guys to create something that can detect when this vulnerability is being exploited so that we can fucking compensate the users that are negatively impacted by it. This sounds like the dumbest thing in the world. There's no shot that this is a real answer. I can't believe this. How old is this video? 7 hours ago. This just sounds crazy to me.
Detections in place to ensure that this type of fraud is not endemic.
Would it not be even better to just say this type of fraud is not possible? Why not just say it's not probable?
He doesn't want to say it, but it's because he feels like the cost of whatever that they're going to lose in revenue of either having a type of encryption that cuts out a certain amount of players from the market that aren't able to do these transactions, it's going to be too costly. So they'd rather
we prefer our customers to have the ease of use to do XYZ.
Well, but ease of use doesn't even matter here because it sounds like MasterCard and other people have figured out the asymmetric.
I'm waiting for the Hassan answer. So
just totally get rid of it by implementing an actual technical change.
If you think about, for every $100 of spend that occurs on card payments, 10 cents of that is lost to fraud. So every $100 is 10 cents. If you look at in-person transactions, which is what kind of this topic is really much more related to, that number goes down to 2 cents for every $100 of fraud that's being made.
Wow,
so I've been thinking about this hack.
He's just saying that like it's not that many people that are impacted, which to some extent, like I get, but for something like this, it's just very clearly like you can't prevent every single type of fraud. You know, like that is true. But for something that's just a procedural vulnerability that I don't, it's not immediately
also, it's
obvious
be,
to me why it would be impossible.
Become bigger.
Sure, yeah, that too. Yeah, I don't know.
Like 10 years ago. Like, we saw the very first rumblings of the people doing the relay attacks to steal cars, right? Like, they would come near your door with a retransmitter, with the keyless access and steal your fucking car. Now that shit happens all the time. So, like, it's going to be more common if you don't fucking fix it, right?
Well, I think most keys are somewhat encrypted right now, right? Like, you can't just have a random key or rebroadcast a random thing to unlock a card or no?
You can, yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah. The only ones that can prevent it are the ones that, like, turn off if there's no movement. Anything else, it works fine.
It reminds me a lot about people who are afraid of flying.
Is this in shitification? No, I don't know how you guys want to work this in here. Yes, this every single thing that happens that's bad for security is in shitification. True. Yes, everything bad is in shitification.
Fine. Statistically, you're a lot more likely to crash on the drive to the airport than you are in the air.
So I do understand Visa's argument generally. Compared to other kinds of fraud, this is just a drop in the ocean. But airlines don't accept a small number of crashes each year as an inevitable cost of doing business. No, anytime there's a crash, they analyze it meticulously. Then they do everything in their power to make sure that it's never going to happen again. Visa.
Well, that's not really true, right? Like, airplanes can crash, and they don't make them so that they never crash, but it's like the odds of it happening should be low enough that the number basically is approaching zero, but...
says that they'll get you your money back, and that's great. But you've still got to notice the charge, dispute it, and then wait. Imagine waking up each year as an inevitable cost, but airlines don't accept a small number of crashes each year as an inevitable cost of doing business.
I mean, you do accept that the small number is just probably less than one or whatever. What do you mean? Like you could always add more security or more stuff. It could be we could have 5 pilots per plane instead of 2, or you could, whatever.
No, anytime there's a crash, they analyze it meticulously. Then they do everything in their power to make sure that it's never going to happen again. Visa says that they'll get you your money back, and that's great. But you've still got to notice the charge, dispute it, and then wait. Imagine waking up to see $10,000 gone from your account. That's money for rent, insurance, car payment, or a medical bill. Even if the refund does come, the stress before is going to be very real. So for me, the question is whether just saying they're going to refund it after the fact is good enough. Or when a system touches the lives of so...
I will say from personal experience, I think twice in my life, though, I think credit card companies do not give a fuck about fraud. Like I said earlier, unless the process has changed, like you have to go through the whole process or whatever, but it does feel like you can just, because I've done this before where I called and I'm like, I think somebody defrauded me or used my card for something. And the person's like, oh, what are the fraudulent transactions? It was like $600. I was like, it was these. And I'm like, okay, we refunded it. We canceled the card. We sent you another one. It's like, oh, okay. I don't know if it's still that easy today or whatever, but they like super don't give a fuck. There is no police investigation. They don't try to figure out who did it. They just refund you the money, like whatever. Now, if it was for really high dollar amounts, I don't know if that'd be the case, but.
So many people, should we expect better?
Jeez.
Sheesh. It's been compared to the iPhone. It's been compared to a Ponzi scheme. Either way, a lot of people are investing and talking about a new product. It's really a stock, specifically preferred stock, called Stretch. And it's sold by MicroStrategy. You may know them. They're the guys who have been buying up a lot of Bitcoin. You may know Michael Saylor from the memes about Bitcoin. He's like, you know, there is no second best but Bitcoin.
There is no second best. There's no second best crypto asset. There's a crypto asset. It's called Bitcoin, right?
Well, now it looks like he's changed his tune because his company is currently raising billions of dollars by offering something called Stretch. The company uses the proceeds from those sales to then go buy more Bitcoin, and they claim that this has been their fastest launch in history. They say it's growing their revenue faster than the iPhone.
So it took us 7 months to go from zero to $5 billion in cumulative revenue.
Wow.
And if you compare this historically to other products, the most successful products in the world, the Apple iPhone took about a year to get to $5 billion of cumulative revenue. So from a pure product perspective, you could argue that Stretch is the fastest growing product in the history of the world.
Whoa. Wow. Now, setting aside the fact that Stretch is not really a product, it's a stock, those are still some mind-blowing numbers. So what does Stretch do? I'm going to try to make it simple. You put in your money, they say they're going to yield about 11.5% a year. Now that is a variable interest rate, but it's basically double-digit returns, which is just mind-blowing. I mean, it's way more than anything you would get in your normal bank account, and that's got people curious. There's always a question with all of this.
Wait, what?
Put in your money, that Stretch is not really a product, it's a stock. Those are still some mind-blowing numbers. So what does Stretch do? I'm gonna...
From your product perspective, you could argue that Stretch is the fastest growing product in the history of the world.
Wow. Now, setting aside the fact that Stretch is not really a product, it's a stock, those are still some mind-blowing numbers. So what does Stretch do? I'm going to try to make it simple. You put in your money, they say they're going to yield about 11.5% a year. Now, that is a variable interest rate, but it's basically double-digit returns, which is just mind-blowing. I mean, it's way more than anything you would get in your normal bank account, and that's got people curious. There's always a question with all of this financial engineering. Anytime you see it, you always wonder, what is the catch? And I like to describe it like a perpetual motion machine. You may have seen, you know, these videos of people, they invent a system that can come up with free energy. And there's always, you know, some weird base plate that's made out of wood or something that they won't let you inspect. And that's because there's always a battery hidden somewhere in the device, because no matter how many times people say they've cheated thermodynamics, actually they've just cheated you. They've hidden the actual system somewhere, and you don't really fully understand that when you're getting in. And that's really how I feel about all too good to be true yields in finance. There's always a battery hiding somewhere, or a risk that you're not really aware you're taking on. Like if you think back to the Terra Luna collapse, there was a stable coin, an algorithmic stable coin involved, which was supposedly pegged to a dollar until it suddenly wasn't. And then everyone lost their money suddenly in a crash. But before that, it had yielded about 20% returns. People thought it couldn't fail. And so it goes for many of the most famous financial engineering projects throughout time. It's only obvious where the risk was in hindsight for a lot of people. But I'm making this video to tell you it's also obvious in foresight if you know where to look. And you just know that super high yields always carry a lot of risk. The only question is, where does that risk exist in any of these engineering projects? And by the way, I'm not just using that word financial engineering as some sort of, you know, gotcha. Like, that's how Michael Saylor describes his own product.
Stretch is the simplest instrument we've ever created from the point of view of the investor, but it's the most ambitious piece of financial engineering from the point of view of the issuer.
And I think this is at the heart of...
I'm sorry, wait, what the fuck is it? You just give them your money and you expect to get 10% or 11% return? Is that... the fuck is this? I support this business. I think this is fine. I think idiots should be parted with their money as quickly as possible. Fuck it.
The mismatch. When most people hear about Stretch, their friends tell them about it. Michael Saylor is talking about it all the time. They're given a very simple view, a very too good to be true view, where Stretch is some money market-like instrument, where it's like a bank, where it's like a savings account, but it's paying you 11.5%. But you dig into the details, and that's not what it is. And the risks are not too different from the risks you have just buying Bitcoin, except the way those risks manifest in the financial engineering instrument are just very different. Instead of getting a very volatile product, you are tying your risk to Bitcoin, more specifically Strategy, and their general ability to pay this yield in perpetuity forever. So this video, I will admit, is gonna be a long one, but maybe we should start by just taking a look at some of these honestly insane ads that they've been running about Stretch. Okay, so this is a tweet from the executive chairman of Strategy, Michael Saylor. It says, "You weren't meant to live an uncomfortable life," and then this is the video.
Are you on vacation here?
I live here.
Oh, this is real.
I'm retired.
I know that girl.
I just don't think I'm meant to live an uncomfortable life.
True.
Wow. How did you make it?
I worked hard as an engineer to save money.
This is the... anybody that says it's not real is banned, by the way. Sponsored.
Again. Then I put my savings into Stretch.
What is Stretch?
Stretch is a stock. Right now I get about 11% a year in dividends. Nice. It's the
Stretch,
yeah, the
Stretch, 11% monthly. Strategy Inc. series, a perpetual Stretch preferred stock. Is it just a bunch of people who are like, give me all your money so I can buy Bitcoin, and hopefully as the price goes up and up and up, I can pay out ridiculous returns while I get ridiculous returns on my Bitcoin until eventually the price crashes, and then I'm going to liquidate the company and exit, and you're all going to get fucked? There's a Ponzi scheme. Whatever.
Okay, I'm going to pause to let your brain absorb the abomination. That was an AI-generated... retired engineer who invested their savings into MicroStrategy's Stretch. Now they're making 11% a year. I mean, do I even need to say it's too good to be true when it's literally a fake ad? Like, this person literally does not exist. But you can see the pitch is pretty simple. They're not explaining the risks. They're just showing you a girl on a beach claiming she's retired. And my point is, this is not a sophisticated pitch, and that's actually by design. Michael Saylor constantly harps about how simple the pitch for Stretch is.
Stretch is the simplest instrument we've ever created.
Here's what I realize, right? The world doesn't want you to write 10,000 pages of history to explain what's going on. They don't have time to read. The world just wants the answer. What do I want? I want to put my money in a bank. I want them to pay me 10%. I don't want the government to tax it. Okay, how long was that conversation? That was like 12 seconds? Mm-hmm.
Right. Wow. So key to strategy is its simplicity, according to Michael Saylor. That's what the world wants. And specifically, he's pitching to retail investors. He's pitching to everyday investors. He
Shrimp
says
lies.
Most of the buyers are everyday people.
In fact, 80% of Stretch is held by retail investors. And so it's meant to be a...
That's how you know it's cooked.
...retail product that's really easily accessible by anybody.
80% of this thing that's raising billions of dollars is being held by
Retards.
Mom and pops, not institutional investors who understand the risks of preferred stocks, who understand that they can suspend dividends if they want, who understand that ultimately MicroStrategy has no obligation to pay you back the initial money you put in. That's fine. That's one thing. But we instead have this product that's being marketed by their own admission to regular people. They admit it's an ambitious piece of financial engineering, but when they talk about it, they're using words like bank. You know, their CEO is recommending it for low-income investors.
But what about people who are watching who maybe live paycheck to paycheck, they're lower income? Is this a product that would make sense for them?
Yeah, you know, this is another sort of aspect of this product that excites me, and I know having written Bitcoin for Everyone, right? Like I'd like to say Stretch is for everyone. And I know this is important to you, is a product that is for people across all income levels.
But is it really for everyone? I mean, if you just have a rainy day fund, should you be investing what was in a money market, what was in a bank, into Stretch, right? The way they talk about it, really, you'd be forgiven for believing that, yes, it's kind of the same. I mean, her question literally was people living paycheck to paycheck.
Paycheck to paycheck.
And he said, yes, you should invest in their preferred stock where the primary risk is tied to both Bitcoin, a known volatile product, and MicroStrategy.
I'd like to say Stretch is for everyone.
Here's Michael Saylor. Stretch delivers money market-like stability with market-leading risk-adjusted returns. Guys, they are comparing themselves very directly to a money market. Once again, here's the CEO.
Think about it as how you might get paid on a money market, or how, and I like the monthly payout because it almost looks like a paycheck.
So again, you can see why this is compelling to people, right? They're presenting it like such a simple thing. It's just like your savings account, right? But better, but just juiced returns. Now, what is the problem with that? Well, ultimately, Stretch is nothing like a savings account. It is a stock, meaning the company has no obligation to pay you that money back. Like, you give them $100, they have no obligation to pay you back. And you actually find this in sort of the longer podcasts where Michael Saylor gets kind of asked about some of the risks of this strategy. And he uses the doublespeak of how they talk about this stuff to, on the one hand, make it seem like, oh, well, Strategy really has no obligation to pay these people, so there's not much risk of a bankruptcy if they can't pay these obligations, while at the same time making it seem like they're definitely going to pay you the money.
When we sell STRC, we're selling equity. When you give me $1 million to buy a preferred equity with a variable dividend, if you read the securities document and you understand what that security is, you're entering into a perpetual swap. I am agreeing as the issuer to give you SOFR, the standard overnight funds rate, plus a credit spread determined by the company.
Oh,
and you are agreeing to give the company that capital forever.
Shrimple.
And so that, and you're not getting the money back. So,
oh, wait, you don't even get back your initial investment. They just pay you out dividends based on. So if I give them $100, I'm guaranteed to get $11 per. It's per year, right? That's not monthly, right?
It's not an overnight loan. There is no collateral call. You have no redemption right. Yeah, you can't. It's not like you can go to the bank and say, give me the $1 million back tomorrow. In fact, you're not getting the money back ever.
Now, that sounds a lot different than like what people imagine when they hear, you know, bond, loan, money market, bank, right?
Would you like a bank account that pays you 11% that's tax deferred? STRC.
When Michael Saylor suddenly says, well, you have no redemption right.
You have no redemption right.
You actually can't get your money back.
In fact, you're not getting the money back ever.
You're giving it to us in perpetuity. Our only obligation is a dividend. A dividend, by the way, which they can suspend to avoid insolvency.
If the company couldn't pay the dividend without being insolvent, it would suspend the dividend for 12 weeks. By law, you can't pay a dividend on a preferred stock that would create an insolvency event for the issuer.
That all of a sudden changes the narrative. But again, that's going to take more time to explain. And Michael Saylor's whole strategy, ironically, is to go with a much simpler pitch, which is, hey, it's just like a money market, but better. It's money market light. And this kind of dual use of language, where there he's kind of defending how it's good for the company. Like, hey, we're not going to get liquidated if Bitcoin goes down because we technically owe these people nothing. We can suspend the dividend.
It is literally impossible to create an insolvency or to bankrupt an issuer of a preferred stock.
But on the other hand, like pitching it like a money market or pitching it like a bank, where in both of those cases, you are reasonable to expect to have your money back. But here, obviously, you don't. Now, why haven't people realized this? Why haven't people realized there could be a risk of this stock going down and them ultimately not getting their $100 back that they put in? Well, this is where we get to some of that financial engineering we were talking about. Part of the way Stretch mimics a bank account, mimics a savings account, is that they are trying to keep it as close to $100 in value at all times. You can see Michael Saylor posted, it's a 1 cent market closed at par, meaning the idea is there's almost no volatility in this stock. You can also see a longer duration here where it mostly hovers around $100. Now, how are they achieving this? Well, it's actually pretty simple. Basically, when it falls below $100, they just raise the dividend, start offering more money until enough people buy it to bring it at $100. And above $100, they issue more shares to make it fall to $100. So you're given this constant impression that this thing is worth $100. So you never fear the idea of this thing falling and losing your principal, even if Strategy won't cash you out. Somebody else hopefully will buy your stock at the same amount you bought it for, and you just collect the dividends, right? That's the idea behind it.
This is the tale of Iron Manny.
The problem with it, well, currently, in order to keep it at par, Michael Saylor says they've raised the dividend rate.
You know this is a great product because Rakita Law endorses it. Wait, really?
5 times.
So what are they going to do if it doesn't trade at $100? They're going to raise the dividend rate. Have they done that? Yeah.
I think that almost, I'm about to make a super broad statement that I have no business making, but everything in finance, everything in investment, everything in gambling that looks too good to be true is usually, there's hidden somewhere a fatal flaw in the risk assessment. And the problem is that the risk assessment always feels way more unlikely than it actually is in practice. The gambler's fallacy is a I don't know if it's called a gambler's fallacy. No, it's not called a gambler's fallacy. But there's a betting strategy that's a good example of this, where if I bet once and I lose, then I'll double my bet next time. If I lose, I'll double it again until I win. And then doing that, I can basically make sure that I'm always winning money. Because if I lose, I just double my next bet to always recapture it. But the problem is people underestimate how quickly you can get into the martingale strategy. There's table limits to prevent some stuff like this. And then two, people underestimate how quickly you can get into absurdly huge amounts of money to where you actually can't double it anymore. And once you eat that loss, you're done. You've wiped out fucking everything in your life because you've had to double up so many times. Like the exponential growth is just, you can't track it. And almost every weird finance thing that seems too good to be true is usually built upon deep down enough some piece of risk that's not being properly evaluated or communicated, basically.
5 times.
So ultimately, Stretch will only stay at $100 and you will not risk losing your principal investment as long as there's another guy willing to buy it at $100. Now, again, they have that lever of increasing the dividend more and more and more to try to keep bringing new people in. But that only lasts as long as people see Strategy as being well-backed enough by Bitcoin. Which brings us back to what this all eventually is. What are your primary risks?
Did I miss it? Did they explain where the money comes from? How can they offer such high dividends? I'm half paying attention because fuck this. It sounds like what they do is you can basically, you give me $100 and here's what I do. I'm going to give you an 11% return on that $100 forever. I take the $100 and I go ahead and I buy Bitcoin and I invest in it. If the Bitcoin is like massively overperforming such that I can, it's overperforming the 11% returns that I promise you, then I continue to pay out your dividend. When it is underperforming, then I can decrease the cost of the shares of the business so that other people eventually buy in to give me more capital to either continue to pay out other people or to continue to put more money into the Bitcoin market to investors, something like this, something akin to this. But the issue is that if this market were to ever drop sufficiently and you don't get new investors, I think you would drop to insolvency like immediately, and then every year you'd have to, you just take everybody's money and run. Your shit would be fucked. You'd never be able to pay out people. You'd stop paying dividends. The original capital, you don't, the investor doesn't even own anymore, and you would just lose. You'd be out all your money. So the people that jump in early right now would be good. I mean, remember, for Ponzi schemes, the first people in usually do get paid out, but eventually there's gonna be a whole bunch of people involved, and it's just fucked, I think. Yeah.
Well, it's Bitcoin, which is volatile, and its strategy itself and their own ability to pay these dividends and not suspend them. Because even though they say they can suspend them, the second they do, you can bet that Stretch is going to fall precipitously. And
I just don't understand. I just don't understand why the fuck you wouldn't just buy the Bitcoin yourself. Am I missing some part of that? Why not just buy it yourself? I don't know.
A lot of people are going to be running for the door, and a lot of people are going to lose money. Now, I want to be clear that I'm not forecasting doom on the horizon of Stretch. I am not even calling it a Ponzi scheme, although I think there are some comparisons you could make. In fact, I think they disclose a lot of the risks in the fine print. My entire problem is that they are leading people like a Pied Piper with this kind of ludicrous idea. Their pitch is of a money market and a bank, when that's just not what this is. And this is a snowball of yield that will accumulate for this company, which admittingly does have tons of Bitcoin. They have this massive treasury, but Bitcoin, it's very well known, does not yield anything. So eventually, Stretch will have to be funded by what exactly, right? They have a cash reserve, but that'll eventually run out. Bitcoin doesn't yield anything, so you'd have to sell it at some point, which would put a negative pressure on your entire treasury. Or they can try to keep issuing shares in perpetuity, but how are they going to do that? Well, maybe they just keep raising the yield of Stretch. Doesn't seem like that would work forever. You can pretty quickly...
MicroStrategy functions exactly like a leveraged Bitcoin tracker up and down. The only reason people buy it is because you can buy their stock without having to fuck with crypto exchanges, and you get exposure at a multiple of the actual Bitcoin action. I don't understand that part. Like, if somebody tells me, bro, you're going to get some crazy levered action on the Bitcoin prices, and I'm like, oh shit, really? Tell me about it. And they're like, yeah, 11% annual returns. I'm like, 11%? What? Where are the levers going? What's being leveraged? It sounds like it's, I don't know if you would say the opposite of leverage. It sounds like what they're doing here is they're just trying to find out a way to smooth the volatility of the returns out. And the guesstimate that they've given is 11.5%, that they can, on average, yield more than that for at least a couple of years. And they're just like smoothing out your returns or something like that. But I might not be fully understanding. I'm not sure.
They realize that, hey, this is maybe not as sustainable as they're claiming it is. That is, of course, unless you believe in what Michael Saylor does. I mean, he says his expected return on Bitcoin is 30% a year.
We think Bitcoin's going up about 30% a year. So can I pay a dividend of 10%, 11%? Yeah, sure I can. That's like one third of my expected ARR.
If you believe what Michael Saylor just said, one, you should just be investing in Bitcoin directly.
Yourself, yeah.
But yeah, they can pay that dividend in perpetuity, of course. If anything goes up 30% a year, they can pay 11% of that to pay some kind of, you know, money market-like account. But that is not where most people are. It's definitely not where most of retail investors are. They aren't in a position where they can make those kind of bets, right? And had that all been properly disclosed up front, had Michael Saylor actually laid out the entire pitch, that's fine. I actually have no problem with people engaging in financial wizardry as long as they're disclosing what it is. But when you mislead people in the pitch, that's where I have my entire problem. So I think people just need to be aware. If you hear people compare Stretch to a bank, to a money market, to any kind of debt instrument where the person is actually obligated to pay you the amount back, please correct them. That is not what is going on here. And the financial engineering is actually to make it look like it's those things.
More so, the obligation to pay you back is fucking whatever, because companies can go under and you're just shit out of luck. The nice thing about, I don't know if this applies to money market deposit accounts, but the nice thing about like bonds and savings accounts is that they're FDIC insured. So the bank, even if the bank goes insolvent, the federal government will make you whole up to $250,000. Yeah, I'm not sure about money market deposit accounts, but... yeah, but these companies, like, you can have a debt obligation from a company that goes under and it's worth fuck all. I mean, people were selling them out Gox claims for pennies on the dollar.
When it is very much, in fact, not. You still have the same risks you have with any stock. You have a concentrated risk to Bitcoin. Your money is not insured. You have no redemption rights. And you can only sell Stretch for what someone else is willing to pay for it. It is not suitable for people living paycheck to paycheck. I can't believe I have to say that, but it is absolutely not appropriate. If you know you need the money, please do not go take a flyer on anything linked to Bitcoin. That is just not the move if you know you're going to need that money very soon. So yeah, I just wanted to talk about
that. Kind of sounds like a hater, though. I feel like he's trying to get in early on the Ponzi scheme, I bet. I bet he bought a whole bunch of this shit before putting a video out on it.
I mean, just in case it wasn't obvious, for the record, I advise people stay away from stuff like this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at least if you're going to do it with all the risks in mind. Take the AI girl on the beach in the bikini out of your head for a moment and just think about the old question. If I can't understand why something is too good to be true, there's probably a risk hidden somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here with MKBHD.
Can you steal $10,000 from a locked iPhone? Fuck.